The story of the wedding feast of Cana is kind of fits into the category of a lot of the other mysteries of the rosary. It's one of the luminous mysteries of the rosary. And, you know, there's 20 decades of the rosary, and there's all the different mysteries of the baptism of Jesus and the wedding feast of Cana and the crucifixion, the resurrection, the nativity, all those kind of... all the various points of reflection that we meditate on in the rosary, and we call them mysteries. And for us as Catholics, it's like, okay, well, we usually don't even question. Yeah, it's a mystery. We go along, and meaning we don't comprehend or understand everything about it, and we can accept that, move right along. But what does it mean when we talk about them being mysteries? Well, it means that there is more beneath the surface than what we simply read in the literal sense of Scripture. In the literal sense, when we just read it and like, okay, well, here's a story. Jesus at a wedding, water changed into wine, cool, got it, move along. What's happening beneath that? What's going on the spiritual level rather than just simply on the literal sense level? Well, this particular mystery, I think, is significant because embedded within it is the foundations of our understanding of marriage as a sacrament. Now, you go back to your second grade education, for those of you who learned the Baltimore Catechism, a sacrament is an outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace. Three parts. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. It's a great... It encapsulates so much information just in that, but an outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace. Now, what's it mean for a sacrament to be outward? All seven sacraments are outward. We can taste, touch, smell, see, and hear them. We know when a sacrament takes place. Our bodies can tell us. Our senses know because there's something sensible about the sacraments. We can taste the bread. We feel the water. We smell the chrism. All of those kind of things, it's something sensible, outward, instituted by Christ in that middle part of the definition, meaning we believe we can trace the roots of all seven sacraments to Jesus' life and ministry. We can point to the New Testament and the Gospels themselves or in the Acts of the Apostles and following the way the apostles lived out and practiced the sacraments. So the institution of baptism, what we celebrated just a couple weeks ago with Jesus' baptism. The institution of the Eucharist and the priesthood at the Last Supper. Take this, all of you, and eat of it. That institution of that sacrament. In the wedding feast of Cana, we see the institution of marriage as a sacrament. An outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace. And that give grace part, it's all seven of the sacraments impart a different kind of grace. So, instituted by Christ, if we're looking at that, we're saying, church claims marriage was instituted by Christ as a sacrament. But what about Abraham and Sarah? What about Moses and Sapphira? What about Adam and Eve? What about all those people who came in the timeline of the Old Testament? Were they married or were they not married? Yes. They were married. We recognize the Old Testament marriage as marriage. But they did not have a sacrament. They had what the church refers to as a natural bond. So, Adam and Eve, Moses and Sapphira, so on and so on. They had a natural bond of marriage. It exists on the natural realm, and it's a good thing. It's not evil or wrong or sinful. It's a good thing, and it brings together a couple for the good of the couple, for the good of their children, for the good of society. It's the kind of the fundamental building block. That's what existed in the Old Testament, and it still exists today. The natural bonds, we still recognize them today. So, marriage existed before Jesus, but so what happened in the wedding feast of Cana that points to this raising and changing from natural to supernatural? It's the water being changed into wine. Now, we notice this. Water is changed into wine, and it tells us a couple of different things. Number one, Jesus liked to party. We're cool with that. Number two, why did he change the water into wine? What's going on there? What's the basis for that? So, did you catch why the water was there in the first place? What was the purpose of the water? 6 stone jars, each holding 20 to 30 gallons, for Jewish ceremonial washings. It's part of the Levitical law in the book of Leviticus. It's laid out, every Jew before they eat has to wash their hands and their face. It's part of the old law. And Jesus and his apostles actually got in trouble a couple times for not following that. But it's part of the Old Testament law. You wash your hands and your face. So if you throw a party, if you're the host, you have to have water available to fulfill the law. That's what those stone jars were there, Jewish ceremonial washings. So you see Jesus taking what already exists, what's part of the old law, the old covenant, the old order. He uses that as the foundation, and he raises it to something new. And moving forward, now do we not only have just a simple natural bond, we have a supernatural bond that is superior to the natural bond, just as wine is superior to water. This natural bond, what we claim is that a couple who receives the natural bond enters into an unbreakable bond, an unbreakable bond. The only thing that we know that breaks a supernatural bond is death itself. And that's why in marriage we say, till death do you part. This unbreakable supernatural bond becomes the very means, the vehicle, the channel, the conduit, the kind of the funnel that collects grace from the Lord and directs it to bride and groom. Marriage itself directs grace to a couple. Just like the Eucharist, when you receive the Eucharist, you receive grace. When you get married, you receive a special kind of grace. And the Eucharist, you receive kind of like a glass of water. It's our daily bread, and it gets us through that day. And then the next day, we got to eat again. But in marriage, rather than just drinking like a glass of water and then you're thirsty again, in marriage, you receive the water tower that lasts a lifetime, a constant source of grace. And the grace that it's supposed to be giving you in your life is the ability to live out your relationship fruitfully. But here's the deal. You think of like a water tower and the line coming to water a garden or to receive it, but that line can be kinked. You see within a marriage when that line is kinked, and that's what, unfortunately, that's what mortal sin does. It kinks the line of grace. It severs that reception of grace from the Lord. And you see the garden of a marriage begin to shrivel up and to dry and to not bear fruit. Sacramental marriage that is essentially, there's an essential difference between a natural bond and a supernatural marriage. It kind of works like a shield. The grace of marriage works like a shield to defend a couple, to protect them from the assaults, the attacks that are coming from the outside. That a couple with a natural bond just simply does not receive that same grace or blessing. All of this embedded within the scripture. And it's there for the taking, it's there for the seeing, but sometimes it got to do a little extracting to see what's going on here. The last point I would like to share is this, and I'll, throughout the next coming months and stuff, I'll circle back around to this idea of sacramental marriage, but the last point I want to make is from the last line of the gospel. Jesus did this as the beginning of his signs in Cana in Galilee, and so revealed his glory in the very last line, and his disciples began to believe in him. Now, the disciples we're talking about are the original apostles, the ones that Jesus went to the Sea of Galilee and brought them along with him, Peter, James, and John. Peter in the boat, you know, hey, throw your net out to that side. And so he hauls in the load of fish, and then he goes to the shore, that dramatic scene of like, depart from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man. And they began following Jesus. They're disciples at this point. They're followers. They know this guy is different. They know this guy, this isn't just a normal dude. They hear him teaching. They hear him preaching. They're so much so that they're willing to follow him, to leave their nets and to go from place to place to place following Jesus. Disciples. But it is not until today, it's not until his glory is revealed, they see the miracle of water change into wine, that they begin to believe in him. In other words, brothers and sisters, and this is a really, really important point, I think, it is possible to be a disciple of Jesus, to follow him, but not believe in him. See what I'm saying? It's possible to be a disciple and to truly follow, I'm following the Lord, but there's a hollowness in that discipleship because we don't believe yet. We've not seen the miracles. We've not seen the water change into wine. We've not seen him walk on water. We've not seen the transfiguration. But even then, even with the apostles who have seen the transfiguration, who have seen, even they still, all but John, still abandoned him and his passion. So the point I'm making is that discipleship is this kind of, there's these ups and downs that happen in discipleship where I want to follow the Lord. I know it's true, but there's something I'm not quite ready to jump in with both feet yet. And it was this witnessing of this miracle, this witnessing of marriage. Water changed to wine, that they began to believe in him. Not fully, but they began. So I just ask you, as we conclude here, where is the Lord changing water into wine in your lives? In the lives of the people around you, who are the disciples, or are you a disciple that follows the Lord but still does not quite believe yet? And that's a hard thing to really truly be honest with yourself about. May we not just be satisfied with the surface level or the mediocre, but to truly see the Lord at work and to follow him with pure conviction, believing that he is who he claims to be.